3. The objects of love. Love is not primarily a relationship to a specific person. It is an attitude, an orientation of character which determines the relatedness of a person to the world as a whole, not toward one object of love. If a person loves only one other person and is indifferent to the rest of his fellow men, his love is not love, but a symbiotic attachment or an enlarged egotism. Yet most people believe that love is constituted by the object, not by the faculty. In fact, they even believe that it is a proof of the intensity of their love when they do not love anybody except the loved person. This is the same fallacy which we have already mentioned above. Because one does not see that love is an activity, a power of the soul, one believes that all that is necessary to find is the right object, and that everything goes by itself afterward. This attitude can be compared to that of a man who wants to paint, but who, instead of learning the art, claims that he has to just wait for the right object, and that he will paint beautifully when he finds it. If I truly love one person, I love all persons. I love the world. I love life. If I can say to somebody else, "I love you," I must be able to say, "I love in you everybody. I love through you the world. I love in you also myself." Saying that love is an orientation which refers to all and not to one does not imply, however, the idea that there are no differences between various types of love, which depend on the kind of object which is loved. Brotherly love. The most fundamental kind of love which underlies all types of love is brotherly love. By this I mean the sense of responsibility, care, respect, knowledge of another human being, the wish to further his life. This is the kind of love the Bible speaks of when it says, "Love thy neighbor as thyself." Brotherly love is love for all human beings. It is characterized by its very lack of exclusiveness. If I have developed the capacity for love, then I cannot help loving my brothers. In brotherly love, there is the experience of union with all men, of human solidarity, of human atonement. Brotherly love is based on the experience that we are all one. The differences in talents, intelligence, knowledge are negligible in comparison with the identity of the human core common to all men. In order to experience this identity, it is necessary to penetrate from the periphery to the core. If I perceive in another person mainly the surface, I perceive mainly the differences, that which separates us. If I penetrate to the core, I perceive our identity, the fact of our brotherhood. This relatedness from center to center, instead of that from periphery to periphery, is central relatedness. Or as Simone Weil expressed it so beautifully, the same words, e.g. a man says to his wife, "I love you," can be commonplace or extraordinary according to the manner in which they are spoken. And this manner depends on the depth of the region in a man's being from which they proceed, without the will being able to do anything. And by a marvelous agreement, they reach the same region in him who hears them. Thus the hearer can discern, if he has any power of discernment, what is the value of the words. Brotherly love is love between equals. But indeed, even as equals, we are not always equal. Inasmuch as we are human, we are all in need of help. Today I, tomorrow you. But this need of help does not mean that the one is helpless, the other powerful. Helplessness is a transitory condition. The ability to stand and walk on one's own feet is the permanent and common one. Yet love of the helpless one, love of the poor and the stranger, are the beginning of brotherly love. To love one's flesh and blood is no achievement. The animal loves its young and cares for them. The helpless one loves his master, since his life depends on him. The child loves his parent, since he needs them. Only in the love of those who do not serve a purpose, love begins to unfold. Significantly, in the Old Testament, the central object of man's love is the poor, the stranger, the widow, and the orphan, and eventually the national enemy, the Egyptian and the Edomite. By having compassion for the helpless one, man begins to develop love for his brother, and in his love for himself, he also loves the one who is in need of help, the frail, insecure human being. Compassion implies the element of knowledge and of identification. "You know the heart of the stranger," says the Old Testament, "for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. Therefore, love the stranger." Motherly love. We have already dealt with the nature of motherly love in a previous section, which discussed the difference between motherly and fatherly love. Motherly love, as I said there, is unconditional affirmation of the child's life and his needs. But one important addition to this description must be made here. Affirmation of the child's life has two aspects. One is the care and responsibility absolutely necessary for the preservation of the child's life and his growth. The other aspect goes further than mere preservation. It is the attitude which instills in the child a love for living, which gives him the feeling, it is good to be alive, it is good to be a little boy or girl, it is good to be on this earth. These two aspects of motherly love are expressed very succinctly in the biblical story of creation. God creates the world and man. This corresponds to the simple care and affirmation of existence. But God goes beyond this minimum requirement. On each day after nature and man is created, God says, it is good. Motherly love, in this second step, makes the child feel it is good to have been born. It instills in the child the love for life, and not only the wish to remain alive. The same idea may be taken to be expressed in another biblical symbolism. The promised land, land is always a mother symbol, is described as flowing with milk and honey. Milk is the symbol of the first aspect of love, that of care and affirmation. Honey symbolizes the sweetness of life, the love for it, and the happiness in being alive. Most mothers are capable of giving milk, but only a minority of giving honey, too. In order to be able to give honey, a mother must not only be a good mother, but a happy person, and this aim is not achieved by many. The effect on the child can hardly be exaggerated. Mother's love for life is as infectious as her anxiety is. Both attitudes have a deep effect on the child's whole personality. One can distinguish indeed among children and adults, those who got only milk and those who got milk and honey. In contrast to brotherly love and erotic love, which are love between equals, the relationship of mother and child is by its very nature one of inequality, where one needs all the help and the other gives it. It is for this altruistic, unselfish character that motherly love has been considered the highest kind of love and the most sacred of all emotional bonds. It seems, however, that the real achievement of motherly love lies not in the mother's love for the small infant, but in her love for the growing child. Actually, the vast majority of mothers are loving mothers as long as the infant is small and still completely dependent on them. Most women want children, are happy with the newborn child, and eager in their care for it. This is so in spite of the fact that they do not get anything in return from the child, except a smile or the expression of satisfaction in his face. It seems that this attitude of love is partly rooted in an instinctive equipment to be found in animals as well as in the human female. But whatever the weight of this instinctive factor may be, there are also specifically human psychological factors which are responsible for this type of motherly love. One may be found in the narcissistic element in motherly love. Inasmuch as the infant is still felt to be part of herself, her love and infatuation may be a satisfaction of her narcissism. Another motivation may be found in a mother's wish for power or possession. The child, being helpless and completely subject to her will, is a natural object of satisfaction for a domineering and possessive woman. Frequent as these motivations are, they are probably less important and less universal than one which can be called the need for transcendence. This need for transcendence is one of the most basic needs of man, rooted in the fact of his self-awareness, in the fact that he is not satisfied with the role of the creature, that he cannot accept himself as dice thrown out of the cup. He needs to feel as the creator, as one transcending the passive role of being created. There are many ways of achieving this satisfaction of creation. The most natural and also the easiest one to achieve is the mother's care and love for her creation. She transcends herself in the infant. Her love for it gives her life meaning and significance. In the very inability of the male to satisfy his need for transcendence by bearing children, lies his urge to transcend himself by the creation of man-made things and of ideas. But the child must grow. It must emerge from mother's womb, from mother's breast. It must eventually become a completely separate human being. The very essence of motherly love is to care for the child's growth, and that means to want the child's separation from herself. Here lies the basic difference to erotic love. In erotic love, two people who were separate become one. In motherly love, two people who are one become separate. The mother must not only tolerate, but she must wish and support the child's separation. It is only at this stage that motherly love becomes such a difficult task that it requires unselfishness, the ability to give everything and to want nothing but the happiness of the loved one. It is also at this stage that many mothers fail in their task of motherly love. The narcissistic, the domineering, the possessive woman can succeed in being a loving mother as long as the child is small. Only the really loving woman, the woman who is happier in giving than in taking, who is firmly rooted in her own existence, can be a loving mother when the child is in the process of separation. Motherly love for the growing child, love which wants nothing for oneself, is perhaps the most difficult form of love to be achieved, and all the more deceptive because of the ease with which a mother can love her small infant. But just because of this difficulty, a woman can be a truly loving mother only if she can love, if she is able to love her husband, other children, strangers, all human beings. The woman who is not capable of love in this sense can be an affectionate mother as long as the child is small, but she cannot be a loving mother, the test of which is the willingness to bear separation, and even after the separation, to go on loving. Erotic love. Brotherly love is love among equals. Motherly love is love for the helpless. Different as they are from each other, they have in common that they are by their very nature not restricted to one person. If I love my brother, I love all my brothers. If I love my child, I love all my children. No, beyond that, I love all children, all that are in need of my help. In contrast to both types of love is erotic love. It is the craving for complete fusion, for union with one other person. It is by its very nature exclusive and not universal. It is also perhaps the most deceptive form of love there is. First of all, it is often confused with the explosive experience of falling in love, the sudden collapse of the barriers which existed until that moment between two strangers. But, as was pointed out before, this experience of sudden intimacy is by its very nature short-lived. After the stranger has become an intimately known person, there are no more barriers to be overcome. There is no more sudden closeness to be achieved. The loved person becomes as well known as oneself, or perhaps I should better say, as little known. If there were more depth in the experience of the other person, if one could experience the infiniteness of his personality, the other person would never be so familiar, and the miracle of overcoming the barriers might occur every day anew. But for most people, their own person, as well as others, is soon explored and soon exhausted. For them, intimacy is established primarily through sexual contact. Since they experience the separateness of the other person primarily as physical separateness, physical union means overcoming separateness. Beyond that, there are other factors which to many people denote the overcoming of separateness. To speak of one's own personal life, one's hopes and anxieties, to show oneself with one's childlike or childish aspects, to establish a common interest vis-a-vis the world, all this is taken as overcoming separateness. Even to show one's anger, one's hate, one's complete lack of inhibition is taken for intimacy, and this may explain the perverted attraction married couples often have for each other, who seem intimate only when they are in bed or when they give vent to their mutual hate and rage. But all these types of closeness tend to become reduced more and more as time goes on. The consequence is one seeks love with a new person, with a new stranger. Again, the stranger is transformed into an intimate person. Again, the experience of falling in love is exhilarating and intense. And again, it slowly becomes less and less intense and ends in the wish for a new conquest, a new love, always with the illusion that the new love will be different from the earlier ones. These illusions are greatly helped by the deceptive character of sexual desire. Sexual desire aims at fusion and is by no means only a physical appetite, the relief of a painful tension. But sexual desire can be stimulated by the anxiety of loneliness, by the wish to conquer or be conquered, by vanity, by the wish to hurt and even to destroy, as much as it can be stimulated by love. It seems that sexual desire can easily blend with and be stimulated by any strong emotion, of which love is only one. Because sexual desire is in the minds of most people coupled with the idea of love, they are easily misled to conclude that they love each other when they want each other physically. Love can inspire the wish for sexual union. In this case, the physical relationship is lacking in greediness, in a wish to conquer or to be conquered, but is blended with tenderness. If erotic love is not also brotherly love, it never leads to union in more than an orgiastic, transitory sense. Sexual attraction creates, for the moment, the illusion of union, yet without love, this union leaves strangers as far apart as they were before. Sometimes it makes them ashamed of each other, or even makes them hate each other, because when the illusion has gone, they feel their estrangement even more markedly than before. Tenderness is by no means, as Freud believed, a sublimation of the sexual instinct. It is the direct outcome of brotherly love and exists in physical as well as in non-physical forms of love. In erotic love, there is an exclusiveness which is lacking in brotherly love and motherly love. This exclusive character of erotic love warrants some further discussion. Frequently, the exclusiveness of erotic love is misinterpreted as meaning possessive attachment. One can often find two people in love with each other who feel no love for anybody else. Their love is, in fact, an egotism à deux. They are two people who identify themselves with each other and who solve the problem of separateness by enlarging the single individual into two. They have the experience of overcoming aloneness, yet since they are separated from the rest of mankind, they remain separated from each other and alienated from themselves. Their experience of union is an illusion. Erotic love is exclusive, but it loves in the other person all of mankind, all that is alive. It is exclusive only in the sense that I can fuse myself fully and intensely with one person only. Erotic love excludes the love for others only in the sense of erotic fusion, full commitment in all aspects of life, but not in the sense of deep brotherly love. Erotic love, if it is love, has one premise, that I love from the essence of my being and experience the other person in the essence of his or her being. In essence, all human beings are identical. We are all part of one. We are one. This being so, it should not make any difference whom we love. Love should be essentially an act of will, of decision to commit my life completely to that one other person. This is indeed the rationale behind the idea of the insolubility of marriage, as it is behind the many forms of traditional marriage in which the two partners never choose each other, but are chosen for each other, and yet are expected to love each other. In contemporary Western culture, this idea appears altogether false. Love is supposed to be the outcome of a spontaneous emotional reaction, of suddenly being gripped by an irresistible feeling. In this view, one sees only the peculiarities of the two individuals involved, and not the fact that all men are part of Adam and all women part of Eve. One neglects to see an important factor in erotic love, that of will. To love somebody is not just a strong feeling. It is a decision. It is a judgment. It is a promise. If love were only a feeling, there would be no basis for the promise to love each other forever. A feeling comes and it may go. How can I judge that it will stay forever when my act does not involve judgment and decision? Taking these views into account, one may arrive at the position that love is exclusively an act of will and commitment, and that therefore, fundamentally, it does not matter who the two persons are. Whether the marriage was arranged by others or the result of individual choice, once the marriage is concluded, the act of will should guarantee the continuation of love. This view seems to neglect the paradoxical character of human nature and of erotic love. We are all one, yet every one of us is a unique, unduplicable entity. In our relationships to each other, the same paradox is repeated. Inasmuch as we are all one, we can love everybody in the same way, in the sense of brotherly love. But inasmuch as we are all also different, erotic love requires certain specific, highly individual elements which exist between some people, but not between all. Both views, then, that of erotic love as completely individual attraction, unique between two specific persons, as well as the other view that erotic love is nothing but an act of will, are true, or, as it may be put more aptly, the truth is neither this nor that. Hence the idea of a relationship which can be easily dissolved if one is not as successful with it is as erroneous as the idea that under no circumstances must the relationship be dissolved. Self-love. While it raises no objection to apply the concept of love to various objects, it is a widespread belief that while it is virtuous to love others, it is sinful to love oneself. It is assumed that to the degree to which I love myself, I do not love others, that self-love is the same as selfishness. This view goes far back in Western thought. Calvin speaks of self-love as a pest. Freud speaks of self-love in psychiatric terms, but nevertheless, his value judgment is the same as that of Calvin. For him, self-love is the same as narcissism, the turning of the libido toward oneself. Narcissism is the earliest stage in human development, and the person who in later life has returned to this narcissistic stage is incapable of love. In the extreme case, he is insane. Freud assumes that love is the manifestation of libido, and that the libido is either turned toward others, love, or toward oneself, self-love. Love and self-love are thus mutually exclusive in the sense that the more there is of one, the less there is of the other. If self-love is bad, it follows that unselfishness is virtuous. These questions arise. Does psychological observation support the thesis that there is a basic contradiction between love for oneself and love for others? Is love for oneself the same phenomenon as selfishness, or are they opposites? Furthermore, is the selfishness of modern man really a concern for himself as an individual, with all his intellectual, emotional, and sensual potentialities? Has he not become an appendage of his socioeconomic role? Is his selfishness identical with self-love, or is it not caused by the very lack of it? Before we start the discussion of the psychological aspect of selfishness and self-love, the logical fallacy in the notion that love for others and love for oneself are mutually exclusive should be stressed. If it is a virtue to love my neighbor as a human being, it must be a virtue and not a vice to love myself, since I am a human being too. There is no concept of man in which I myself am not included. A doctrine which proclaims such an exclusion proves itself to be intrinsically contradictory. The idea expressed in the biblical "love thy neighbor as thyself" implies that respect for one's own integrity and uniqueness, love for and understanding of one's own self, cannot be separated from respect and love and understanding for another individual. The love for my own self is inseparably connected with the love for any other being. We have come now to the basic psychological premises on which the conclusions of our argument are built. Generally, these premises are as follows. Not only others, but we also are the object of our feelings and attitudes. The attitudes toward others and toward ourselves, far from being contradictory, are basically conjunctive. With regard to the problem under discussion, this means love of others and love of ourselves are not alternatives. On the contrary, an attitude of love toward themselves will be found in all who are capable of loving others. Love, in principle, is indivisible as far as the connection between objects and one's own self is concerned. Genuine love is an expression of productiveness and implies care, respect, responsibility, and knowledge. It is not an effect in the sense of being affected by somebody, but an active striving for the growth and happiness of the loved person, rooted in one's own capacity to love. To love somebody is the actualization and concentration of the power to love. The basic affirmation contained in love is directed toward the beloved person as an incarnation of essentially human qualities. Love of one person implies love of man as such, the kind of division of labor, as William James calls it, by which one loves one's family but is without feeling for the stranger, is a sign of a basic inability to love. Love of man is not, as is frequently supposed, an abstraction coming from the love for a specific person, but it is its premise, although genetically it is acquired in loving specific individuals. From this it follows that my own self must be as much an object of my love as another person. The affirmation of one's own life, happiness, growth, freedom is rooted in one's capacity to love, i.e., in care, respect, responsibility, and knowledge. If an individual is able to love productively, he loves himself, too. If he can love only others, he cannot love at all. Granted that love for oneself and for others, in principle, is conjunctive, how do we explain selfishness, which obviously excludes any genuine concern for others? The selfish person is interested only in himself, wants everything for himself, feels no pleasure in giving, but only in taking. The world outside is looked at only from the standpoint of what he can get out of it. He lacks interest in the needs of others and respect for their dignity and integrity. He can see nothing but himself. He judges everyone and everything from its usefulness to him. He is basically unable to love. Does not this prove that concern for others and concern for oneself are unavoidable alternatives? This would be so if selfishness and self-love were identical, but that assumption is the very fallacy which has led to so many mistaken conclusions concerning our problem. Selfishness and self-love, far from being identical, are actually opposites. The selfish person does not love himself too much, but too little. In fact, he hates himself. This lack of fondness and care for himself, which is only one expression of his lack of productiveness, leaves him empty and frustrated. He is necessarily unhappy and anxiously concerned to snatch from life the satisfactions which he blocks himself from attaining. He seems to care too much for himself, but actually he only makes an unsuccessful attempt to cover up and compensate for his failure to care for his real self. Freud holds that the selfish person is narcissistic, as if he had withdrawn his love from others and turned it toward his own person. It is true that selfish persons are incapable of loving others, but they are not capable of loving themselves either. It is easier to understand selfishness by comparing it with greedy concern for others, as we find it, for instance, in an over-solicitous mother. While she consciously believes that she is particularly fond of her child, she has actually a deeply repressed hostility toward the object of her concern. She is over-concerned not because she loves the child too much, but because she has to compensate for her lack of capacity to love him at all. This theory of the nature of selfishness is borne out by psychoanalytic experience with neurotic unselfishness, a symptom of neurosis observed in not a few people who usually are troubled not by this symptom but by others connected with it, like depression, tiredness, inability to work, failure in love relationships, and so on. Not only is unselfishness not felt as a symptom, it is often the one redeeming character trait on which such people pride themselves. The unselfish person does not want anything for himself. He lives only for others, is proud that he does not consider himself important. He is puzzled to find that in spite of his unselfishness, he is unhappy, and that his relationships to those closest to him are unsatisfactory. Analytic work shows that his unselfishness is not something apart from his other symptoms, but one of them. In fact, often the most important one, that he is paralyzed in his capacity to love or to enjoy anything, that he is pervaded by hostility toward life, and that behind the facade of unselfishness, a subtle but not less intense self-centeredness is hidden. This person can be cured only if his unselfishness too is interpreted as a symptom along with the others, so that his lack of productiveness, which is at the root of both his unselfishness and his other troubles, can be corrected. The nature of unselfishness becomes particularly apparent in its effect on others, and most frequently in our culture, in the effect the unselfish mother has on her children. She believes that by her unselfishness, her children will experience what it means to be loved and to learn in turn what it means to love. The effect of her unselfishness, however, does not at all correspond to her expectations. The children do not show the happiness of persons who are convinced that they are loved. They are anxious, tense, afraid of the mother's disapproval, and anxious to live up to her expectations. Usually, they are affected by the mother's hidden hostility toward life, which they sense rather than recognize clearly, and eventually they become imbued with it themselves. Altogether, the effect of the unselfish mother is not too different from that of the selfish one. Indeed, it is often worse, because the mother's unselfishness prevents the children from criticizing her. They are put under the obligation not to disappoint her. They are taught, under the mask of virtue, dislike for life. If one has a chance to study the effect of a mother with genuine self-love, one can see that there is nothing more conducive to giving a child the experience of what love, joy, and happiness are than being loved by a mother who loves herself. These ideas on self-love cannot be summarized better than by quoting Meister Eckhart on this topic. If you love yourself, you love everybody else as you do yourself. As long as you love another person less than you love yourself, you will not really succeed in loving yourself. But if you love all alike, including yourself, you will love them as one person, and that person is both God and man. Thus, he is a great and righteous person who, loving himself, loves all others equally. Love of God. It has been stated above that the basis for our need to love lies in the experience of separateness and the resulting need to overcome the anxiety of separateness by the experience of union. The religious form of love, that which is called the love of God, is, psychologically speaking, not different. It springs from the need to overcome separateness and to achieve union. In fact, the love of God has as many different qualities and aspects as the love of man has, and to a large extent we find the same differences. In all theistic religions, whether they are polytheistic or monotheistic, God stands for the highest value, the most desirable good. Hence, the specific meaning of God depends on what is the most desirable good for a person. The understanding of the concept of God must, therefore, start with an analysis of the character structure of the person who worships God. The development of the human race, as far as we have any knowledge of it, can be characterized as the emergence of man from nature, from mother, from the bonds of blood and soil. In the beginning of human history, man, though thrown out of the original unity with nature, still clings to these primary bonds. He finds his security by going back, or holding on to these primary bonds. He still feels identified with the world of animals and trees, and tries to find unity by remaining one with the natural world. Many primitive religions bear witness to this stage of development. An animal is transformed into a totem. One wears animal masks in the most solemn religious acts or in war. One worships an animal as God. At a later stage of development, when human skill has developed to the point of artisan and artistic skill, when man is not dependent any more exclusively on the gifts of nature, the fruit he finds and the animal he kills, the man transforms the product of his own hand into a god. This is the stage of the worship of idols made of clay, silver, or gold. Man projects his own powers and skills into the things he makes, and thus in an alienated fashion worships his prowess, his possessions. At a still later stage, man gives his gods the form of human beings. It seems that this can happen only when he has become still more aware of himself and when he has discovered man as the highest and most dignified thing in the world. In this phase of anthropomorphic god worship, we find a development in two dimensions. The one refers to the female or male nature of the gods, the other to the degree of maturity which man has achieved, and which determines the nature of his gods and the nature of his love of them. Let us first speak of the development from mother-centered to father-centered religions. According to the great and decisive discoveries of Bachofen and Morgan in the middle of the 19th century, and in spite of the rejection their findings have found in most academic circles, there can be little doubt that there was a matriarchal phase of religion preceding the patriarchal one, at least in many cultures. In the matriarchal phase, the highest being is the mother. She is the goddess. She is also the authority in family and society. In order to understand the essence of matriarchal religion, we have only to remember what has been said about the essence of motherly love. Mother's love is unconditional. It is all-protective, all-enveloping. Because it is unconditional, it can also not be controlled or acquired. Its presence gives the loved person a sense of bliss. Its absence produces a sense of lostness and utter despair. Since mother loves her children because they are her children, and not because they are good, obedient, or fulfill her wishes and commands, mother's love is based on equality. All men are equal because they are all children of a mother, because they are all children of Mother Earth. The next stage of human evolution, the only one of which we have thorough knowledge and do not need to rely on inferences and reconstruction, is the patriarchal phase. In this phase, the mother is dethroned from her supreme position and the father becomes the supreme being, in religion as well as in society. The nature of fatherly love is that he makes demands, establishes principles and laws, and that his love for the son depends on the obedience of the latter to these demands. He likes best the son who is most like him, who is most obedient, and who is best fitted to become his successor as the inheritor of his possessions. The development of patriarchal society goes together with the development of private property. As a consequence, patriarchal society is hierarchical. The equality of the brothers gives way to competition and mutual strife. Whether we think of the Indian, Egyptian, or Greek cultures, or of the Jewish, Christian, or Islamic religions, we are in the middle of a patriarchal world, with its male gods over whom one chief god reigns, or where all gods have been eliminated with the exception of the one, the god. However, since the wish for mother's love cannot be eradicated from the hearts of man, it is not surprising that the figure of the loving mother could never be fully driven out from the pantheon. In the Jewish religion, the mother aspects of God are reintroduced especially in the various currents of mysticism. In the Catholic religion, mother is symbolized by the Church and by the Virgin. Even in Protestantism, the figure of mother has not been entirely eradicated, although she remains hidden. Luther established as his main principle that nothing that man does can produce God's love. God's love is grace. The religious attitude is to have faith in this grace and to make oneself small and helpless. No good works can influence God or make God love us, as Catholic doctrines postulated. We can recognize here that the Catholic doctrine of good works is part of the patriarchal picture. I can procure Father's love by obedience and by fulfilling his demands. The Lutheran doctrine, on the other hand, in spite of its manifest patriarchal character, carries within it a hidden matriarchal element. Mother's love cannot be acquired. It is there, or it is not there. All I can do is to have faith. As the psalmist says, Thou hast let me have faith into my mother's breast, Psalm 22:9, and to transform myself into the helpless, powerless child. But it is the peculiarity of Luther's faith that the figure of the mother has been eliminated from the manifest picture and replaced by that of the father. Instead of the certainty of being loved by mother, intense doubt, hoping against hope for unconditional love by father, has become the paramount feature. I had to discuss this difference between the matriarchal and patriarchal elements in religion in order to show that the character of the love of God depends on the respective weight of the matriarchal and the patriarchal aspects of religion. The patriarchal aspect makes me love God like a father. I assume he is just and strict, that he punishes and rewards, and eventually that he will elect me as his favorite son, as God elected Abraham, Israel, as Isaac elected Jacob, as God elects his favorite nation. In the matriarchal aspect of religion, I love God as an all-embracing mother. I have faith in her love, that no matter whether I am poor or powerless, no matter whether I have sinned, she will love me. She will not prefer any other of her children to me. Whatever happens to me, she will rescue me, will save me, will forgive me. Needless to say, my love for God and God's love for me cannot be separated. If God is a father, he loves me like a son, and I love him like a father. If God is mother, her and my love are determined by this fact. The difference between the motherly and the fatherly aspects of the love of God is, however, only one factor in determining the nature of this love. The other factor is the degree of maturity reached by the individual, hence in his concept of God and in his love for God. Since the evolution of the human race shifted from a mother-centered to a father-centered structure of society, as well as of religion, we can trace the development of a maturing love mainly in the development of patriarchal religion. In the beginning of this development, we find a despotic, jealous God who considers man, whom he created, as his property and is entitled to do with him whatever he pleases. This is the phase of religion in which God drives man out of paradise, lest he eat from the tree of knowledge and thus could become God himself. This is the phase in which God decides to destroy the human race by the flood, because none of them pleases him, with the exception of the favorite son Noah. This is the phase in which God demands from Abraham that he kill his only, his beloved son Isaac, to prove his love for God by the act of ultimate obedience. But simultaneously, a new phase begins. God makes a covenant with Noah, in which he promises never to destroy the human race again, a covenant by which he has bound himself. Not only is he bound by his promises, he is also bound by his own principle, that of justice, and on this basis, God must yield to Abraham's demand to spare Sodom if there are at least 10 just men. But the development goes further than transforming God from the figure of a despotic tribal chief into a loving father, into a father who himself is bound by the principles which he has postulated. It goes in the direction of transforming God from the figure of a father into a symbol of his principles, those of justice, truth, and love. God is truth. God is justice. In this development, God ceases to be a person, a man, a father. He becomes the symbol of the principle of unity behind the manifoldness of phenomena, of the vision of the flower which will grow from the spiritual seed within man. God cannot have a name. A name always denotes a thing or a person, something finite. How can God have a name if he is not a person, not a thing? The most striking incident of this change lies in the biblical story of God's revelation to Moses. When Moses tells him that the Hebrews will not believe that God has sent him unless he can tell them God's name, how could idol worshippers comprehend a nameless God, since the very essence of an idol is to have a name? God makes a concession. He tells Moses that his name is, I am becoming that which I am becoming. I am becoming is my name. The I am becoming means that God is not finite, not a person, not a being. The most adequate translation of the sentence would be, tell them that my name is nameless. The prohibition to make any image of God, to pronounce his name in vain, eventually to pronounce his name at all, aims at the same goal, that of freeing man from the idea that God is a father, that he is a person. In the subsequent theological development, the idea is carried further in the principle that one must not even give God any positive attribute. To say of God that he is wise, strong, good, implies again that he is a person. The most I can do is say what God is not, to state negative attributes, to postulate that he is not limited, not unkind, not unjust. The more I know what God is not, the more knowledge I have of God. Following the maturing idea of monotheism and its further consequences can lead only to one conclusion, not to mention God's name at all, not to speak about God. Then God becomes what he potentially is in monotheistic theology, the nameless one, an inexpressible stammer, referring to the unity underlying the phenomenal universe, the ground of all existence. God becomes truth, love, justice. God is I, inasmuch as I am human. Quite evidently, this evolution from the anthropomorphic to the pure monotheistic principle makes all the difference to the nature of the love of God. The God of Abraham can be loved or feared as a father, sometimes his forgiveness, sometimes his anger being the dominant aspect. Inasmuch as God is the Father, I am the child. I have not emerged fully from the autistic wish for omniscience and omnipotence. I have not yet acquired the objectivity to realize my limitations as a human being, my ignorance, my helplessness. I still claim, like a child, that there must be a Father who rescues me, who watches me, who punishes me, a Father who likes me when I am obedient, who is flattered by my praise and angry because of my disobedience. Quite obviously, the majority of people have, in their personal development, not overcome this infantile stage, and hence the belief in God to most people is the belief in a helping father, a childish illusion. in spite of the fact that this concept of religion has been overcome by some of the great teachers of the human race and by a minority of men, it is still the dominant form of religion. Inasmuch as this is so, the criticism of the idea of God, as it was expressed by Freud, is quite correct. The error, however, was in the fact that he ignored the other aspect of monotheistic religion, and its true kernel, the logic of which leads exactly to the negation of this concept of God. The truly religious person, if he follows the essence of the monotheistic idea, does not pray for anything, does not expect anything from God. He does not love God as a child loves his father or his mother. He has acquired the humility of sensing his limitations, to the degree of knowing that he knows nothing about God. God becomes to him a symbol in which man, at an earlier stage of his evolution, has expressed the totality of that which man is striving for, the realm of the spiritual world, of love, truth, and justice. He has faith in the principles which God represents. He thinks truth, lives love and justice, and considers all of his life only valuable inasmuch as it gives him the chance to arrive at an even fuller unfolding of his human powers, as the only reality that matters, as the only object of ultimate concern, and, eventually, he does not speak about God, nor even mention his name. To love God, if he were going to use this word, would mean, then, to long for the attainment of the full capacity to love, for the realization of that which God stands for in oneself. From this point of view, the logical consequence of monotheistic thought is the negation of all theology, of all knowledge about God. Yet there remains a difference between such a radical non-theological view and a non-theistic system, as we find it, for instance, in early Buddhism or in Taoism. In all theistic systems, even a non-theological mystical one, there is the assumption of the reality of the spiritual realm as one transcending man, giving meaning and vitality to man's spiritual powers and his striving for salvation and inner birth. In a non-theistic system, there exists no spiritual realm outside of man or transcending him. The realm of love, reason, and justice exists as a reality only because, and inasmuch as, man has been able to develop these powers in himself throughout the process of his evolution. In this view, there is no meaning to life, except the meaning man himself gives to it. Man is utterly alone, except inasmuch as he helps another. Having spoken of the love of God, I want to make it clear that I myself do not think in terms of a theistic concept, and that to me the concept of God is only a historically conditioned one, in which man has expressed his experience of his higher powers, his longing for truth and for unity at a given historical period. But I believe also that the consequences of strict monotheism and a non-theistic ultimate concern with the spiritual reality are two views which, though different, need not fight each other. At this point, however, another dimension of the problem of the love of God arises, which must be discussed in order to fathom the complexity of the problem. I refer to a fundamental difference in the religious attitude between the East, China and India, and the West. This difference can be expressed in terms of logical concepts. Since Aristotle, the Western world has followed the logical principles of Aristotelian philosophy. This logic is based on the law of identity, which states that A is A, the law of contradiction, A is not A, and the law of the excluded middle, A cannot be A and non-A, neither A nor non-A. Aristotle explains his position very clearly in the following sentence. It is impossible for the same thing at the same time to belong and not to belong to the same thing and in the same respect. And whatever other distinctions we might add to meet dialectical objections, let them be added. This, then, is the most certain of all principles. This axiom of Aristotelian logic has so deeply imbued our habits of thought that it is felt to be natural and self-evident, while on the other hand, the statement that X is A and not A seems to be nonsensical. Of course, the statement refers to the subject X at any given time, not to X now and X later, or one aspect of X as against another aspect. In opposition to Aristotelian logic is what one might call paradoxical logic, which assumes that A and non-A do not exclude each other as predicates of X. Paradoxical logic was predominant in Chinese and Indian thinking, in the philosophy of Heraclitus, and then again, under the name of dialectics, it became the philosophy of Hegel and of Marx. The general principle of paradoxical logic has been clearly described by Lao Tse. Words that are strictly true seem to be paradoxical. And by Chuang Tzu, that which is one is one, that which is not one is also one. These formulations of paradoxical logic are positive. It is, and it is not. Another formulation is negative. It is neither this nor that. The former expression of thought we find in Taoism thought, in Heraclitus, and again in Hegelian dialectics. The latter formulation is frequent in Indian philosophy. Although it would transcend the scope of this book to give a more detailed description of the difference between Aristotelian and paradoxical logic, I shall mention a few illustrations in order to make the principle more understandable. Paradoxical logic in Western thought has its earliest philosophical expression in Heraclitus' philosophy. He assumes the conflict between opposites is the basis of all existence. They do not understand, he says, that the all-one, conflicting in itself, is identical with itself, conflicting harmony, as in the bow and in the lyre. Or still more clearly, we go into the same river, and yet not in the same. It is we, and it is not we. Or one and the same manifests itself in things as living and dead, waking and sleeping, young and old. In Lao Tse's philosophy, the same idea is expressed in a more poetic form. A characteristic example of Taoist paradoxical thinking is the following statement: gravity is the root of lightness, stillness the ruler of movement. Or, the Tao in its regular course does nothing, and so there is nothing which he does not do. Or, my words are very easy to know and very easy to practice, but there is no one in the world who is able to know and able to practice them. In Taoist thinking, just as in Indian and Socratic thinking, the highest step to which thought can lead is to know that we do not know. To know and yet think we do not know is the highest attainment. Not to know and yet think we do know is a disease. It is only a consequence of this philosophy that the highest God cannot be named. The ultimate reality, the ultimate one, cannot be caught in words or in thoughts. As Lao Tse puts it, the Tao that can be trodden is not the enduring and unchanging Tao. The name that can be named is not the enduring and unchanging name. Or in a different formulation, we look at it and we do not see it, and we name it the equable. We listen to it and we do not hear it, and we name it the inaudible. We try to grasp it and do not get a hold of it, and we name it the subtle. With these three qualities, it cannot be made the subject of description, and hence we blend them together and obtain the one. And still another formulation of the same idea: he who knows the Tao does not care to speak about it. He who is, however, ready to speak about it does not know it. Brahman philosophy was concerned with the relationship between manifoldness of phenomena and unity, Brahman. But paradoxical philosophy is neither in India nor in China to be confused with a dualistic standpoint. The harmony, unity, consists in the conflicting position from which it is made up. Brahmanical thinking was centered from the beginning around the paradox of the simultaneous antagonisms, yet identity of the manifest forces and forms of the phenomenal world. The ultimate power in the universe, as well as in man, transcends both the conceptual and the sensual sphere. It is therefore neither this nor thus. But, as Zimmer remarks, there is no antagonism between real and unreal in this strictly non-dualistic realization. In their search for unity behind manifoldness, the Brahman thinkers came to the conclusion that the perceived pair of opposites reflects the nature not of things, but of the perceiving mind. The perceiving thought must transcend itself if it is to attain true reality. Opposition is a category of man's mind, not in itself an element of reality. In the Rig Veda, the principle is expressed in this form: I am the two, the life force and the life material, the two at once. The ultimate consequence of the idea that thought can only perceive in contradictions has found an even more drastic sequence in Vedantic thinking, which postulates that thought, with all its fine distinction, was only a more subtle horizon of ignorance, in fact, the most subtle of all the deluding devices of Maya. Paradoxical logic has a significant bearing on the concept of God. Inasmuch as God represents the ultimate reality, and inasmuch as the human mind perceives reality in contradictions, no positive statement can be made of God. In the Vedantas, the idea of an omniscient and omnipotent God is considered the ultimate form of ignorance. We see here the connection with the namelessness of the Tao, the nameless name of the God who reveals himself to Moses, of the absolute nothing of Meister Eckhart. Man can only know the negation, never the position of ultimate reality. Meanwhile, man cannot know what God is, even though he be ever so well aware of what God is not. Thus contented with nothing, the mind clamors for the highest good of all. For Meister Eckhart, the Divine One is a negation of negations and a denial of denials. Every creature contains a negation. One denies that it is the other. It is only a further consequence that God becomes, for Meister Eckhart, the absolute nothing, just as the ultimate reality is the En Sof, the endless one, for the Kabbalah. I have discussed the difference between Aristotelian and paradoxical logic in order to prepare the ground for an important difference in the concept of the love of God. The teachers of paradoxical logic say that man can perceive reality only in contradictions, and can never perceive in thought the ultimate reality unity, the one itself. This led to the consequence that one did not seek as the ultimate aim to find the answer in thought. Thought can only lead us to the knowledge that it cannot give us the ultimate answer. The world of thought remains caught in the paradox. The only way in which the world can be grasped ultimately lies not in thought, but in the act, in the experience of oneness. Thus, paradoxical logic leads to the conclusion that the love of God is neither the knowledge of God in thought, nor the thought of one's love of God, but the act of experiencing the oneness with God. This leads to the emphasis on the right way of living. All of life, every little and every important action, is devoted to the knowledge of God, but a knowledge not in right thought, but in right action. This can be clearly seen in Oriental religions. In Brahmanism, as well as Buddhism and Taoism, the ultimate aim of religion is not the right belief, but the right action. We find the same emphasis in the Jewish religion. There was hardly ever a schism over belief in the Jewish tradition. The one great exception, the difference between Pharisees and Sadducees, was essentially one of two opposite social classes. The emphasis of the Jewish religion was, especially from the beginning of our era on the right way of living, the halakha, this word actually having the same meaning as the Tao. In modern history, the same principle is expressed in the thought of Spinoza, Marx, and Freud. In Spinoza's philosophy, the emphasis is shifted from the right belief to the right conduct of life. Marx stated the same principle when he said, "The philosophers have interpreted the world in different ways. The task is to transform it." Freud's paradoxical logic leads him to the process of psychoanalytic therapy, the ever-deepening experience of oneself. From the standpoint of paradoxical logic, the emphasis is not on thought, but on the act. This attitude had several other consequences. First of all, it led to the tolerance which we find in Indian and Chinese religious development. If the right thought is not the ultimate truth and not the way to salvation, there is no reason to fight others whose thinking has arrived at different formulations. This tolerance is beautifully expressed in the story of several men who were asked to describe an elephant in the dark. One, touching his trunk, said, "This animal is like a water pipe." Another, touching his ear, said, "This animal is like a fan." A third, touching his legs, described the animal as a pillar. Secondly, the paradoxical standpoint led to the emphasis on transforming man, rather than to the development of dogma on the one hand and science on the other. From the Indian, Chinese, and mystical standpoints, the religious task of man is not to think right, but to act right, and or to become one with the one in the act of concentrated meditation. The opposite is true for the mainstream of Western thought. Since one expected to find the ultimate truth in the right thought, major emphasis was on thought, although right action was held to be important too. In religious development, this led to the formulation of dogmas, endless arguments about dogmatic formulations, and intolerance of the non-believer or heretic. It furthermore led to the emphasis on believing in God as the main aim of a religious attitude. This, of course, did not mean that there was not also the concept that one ought to live right. But nevertheless, the person who believed in God, even if he did not live God, felt himself to be superior to the one who lived God but did not believe in him. The emphasis on thought has also another, and historically a very important consequence. The idea that one could find the truth in thought led not only to dogma, but also to science. In scientific thought, the correct thought is all that matters, both from the aspect of intellectual honesty as well as from the aspect of the application of scientific thought to practice, that is, to technique. In short, paradoxical thought led to tolerance and an effort toward self-transformation. The Aristotelian standpoint led to dogma and science, to the Catholic Church, and to the discovery of atomic energy. The consequences of this difference between the two standpoints for the problem of the love of God have already been explained implicitly and need only to be summarized briefly. In the dominant Western religious system, the love of God is essentially the same as the belief in God's existence, God's justice, God's love. The love of God is essentially a thought experience. In the Eastern religions and in mysticism, the love of God is an intense feeling experience of oneness, inseparably linked with the expression of this love in every act of living. The most radical formulation has been given to this goal by Meister Eckhart. If therefore I am changed into God, and he makes me one with himself, then by the living God there is no distinction between us. Some people imagine that they are going to see God, that they are going to see God as if he were standing yonder and they here, but it is not to be so. God and I, we are one. By knowing God, I take him to myself. By loving God, I penetrate him. We can return now to an important parallel between the love for one's parents and the love for God. The child starts out by being attached to his mother as the ground of all being. He feels helpless and needs the all-enveloping love of mother. He then turns to father as the new center of his affections, father being a guiding principle for thought and action. In this stage, he is motivated by the need to acquire father's praise and to avoid his displeasure. In the stage of full maturity, he has freed himself from the person of mother and of father as protecting and commanding powers. He has established the motherly and fatherly principles in himself. He has become his own father and mother. He is father and mother. In the history of the human race, we see and can anticipate the same development. From the beginning of the love for God as the helpless attachment to a mother goddess, through the obedient attachment to a fatherly God, to a mature stage where God ceases to be an outside power, where man has incorporated the principles of love and justice into himself, where he has become one with God, and eventually, to a point where he speaks of God only in a poetic, symbolic sense. From these considerations, it follows that the love for God cannot be separated from the love for one's parents. If a person does not emerge from incestuous attachment to mother, clan, nation, if he retains the childish dependence on a punishing and rewarding father or any other authority, he cannot develop a more mature love for God. Then his religion is that of the earlier phase of religion, in which God was experienced as an all-protective mother or a punishing, rewarding father. In contemporary religion, we find all the phases, from the earliest and most primitive development to the highest, still present. The word God denotes the tribal chief as well as the absolute nothing. In the same way, each individual retains in himself, in his unconscious, as Freud has shown, all the stages from the helpless infant on. The question is to what point he has grown. One thing is certain, the nature of his love for God corresponds to the nature of his love for man, and furthermore, the real quality of his love for God and man is often unconscious, covered up and rationalized by a more mature thought of what love is. Love for man, furthermore, while directly embedded in his relations to his family, is in the last analysis determined by the structure of the society in which he lives. If the social structure is one of submission to authority, overt authority, or the anonymous authority of the market and public opinion, his concept of God must be infantile and far from the mature concept, the seeds of which are to be found in the history of monotheistic religion.